On this edition for Sunday, July 19th, coronavirus cases continue to climb globally. Workers' compensation concerns for healthcare workers exposed to COVID-19. And in our signature segment, aging caregivers on planning for the future. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. President Trump is trailing presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden by double digits in a new national poll today. The Washington Post ABC survey shows 55% of registered voters question support Biden, while 40% said they prefer Mr. Trump. The president used a wide-ranging one-hour interview with Fox News anchor Chris Wallace to say he won't commit to accepting election results in November, and again raise questions about mail-in voting.
I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do. Are
you suggesting that you might not accept the results of the election?
I have to see.
In 2016, the president also said he might not accept election results in a debate with Democrat Hillary Clinton. Mr. Trump said his administration is not trying to discredit Dr. Anthony Fauci, even though a Facebook post from one of his top aides mocked Dr. Fauci as Dr. Fawcett.
It shows him as a leaker and an alarmist.
Oh, I don't know that
why,
he's a leaker.
Why would
he's
say
a little
that?
Bit of an alarmist. That's okay. A little bit
he's
of an
a
alarmist.
Bit of an alarmist?
A little bit of an alarmist.
Questioned about the rising number of coronavirus cases, the president falsely claimed that the U.S. has the lowest mortality rate in the world.
I heard we have one of the lowest, maybe the lowest mortality rate anywhere in the world. Do you have the numbers, please? Because I heard we had the best mortality rate.
The case rate of similarly situated countries, as Dr. Burks points out, and this is...
Number one low mortality rate.
The U.S. mortality rate is currently 3.8%, the eighth highest in the world, according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Center. New confirmed coronavirus infections reached record highs for the second day in a row yesterday, according to the World Health Organization. Globally, there are now more than 14.3 million confirmed cases and more than 602,000 deaths, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins University. The United States continues to lead the world with more than 3.7 million cases and more than 140,000 deaths. While testing has increased over the past month, the percentage of positive tests has also been rising, a sign that the virus is spreading, not just being detected more often. Amid growing concerns about the length of time many people are waiting for test results, this weekend the Food and Drug Administration authorized pool testing for the first time. Labs can now combine or pool up to 4 samples. If there's a positive result, samples are retested individually. This method is already being used to detect COVID-19 in China, Germany, and Israel, and could expand testing capability and conserve testing supplies. Across the United States, confirmed infections are rising on average in the majority of states. In Florida today, state health officials announced more than 12,000 new infections and 89 deaths in the last 24 hours. The death toll in Florida is now more than 5,000. Texas also remains a hot spot, with the state reporting more than 10,000 new cases yesterday for the fifth day in a row. For an update on what's happening in Texas, we turn to Joey Palacio of Texas Public Radio. Joey, what's the situation like in San Antonio and more broadly in Texas?
One of the biggest increases we've ever seen in any city happened on Thursday, when the city added more than 5,500 new cases of COVID-19 in a single day. Now, that is actually the result of a backlog from a state lab that the city got all at once. Yesterday in San Antonio, we saw 1,100 cases added, and we're seeing over 1,000 cases added in some Texas cities. And there's even been some dispute between the San Antonio Metropolitan Health Department and also the state on different forms of testing.
So there's a discrepancy in what test result constitutes positive in Texas?
Right. So there's two types of tests that are used. One is a molecular test, also known as PCR, and then there are antigen tests. Where the discrepancy is happening is while San Antonio is considering both the molecular and the antigen test in its total test results, the state is only taking the molecular tests. They had to subtract 3,500 cases. And this week also, Texas crossed 300,000 cases. I think we're approaching, if not already over, 320,000 cases. And a lot of this, over, I would say about half, has happened within the last month. So Texas is seeing a skyrocketing amount of cases.
What's been happening along the Rio Grande Valley, the border towns?
So there's a county called Hidalgo County. On Friday, for instance, there were 450 people who tested positive. And this is a county of about 800,000 people or so. They have 267 deaths in Hidalgo County. Again, its population is around 800,000. Whereas here in Bexar County in San Antonio, we also have about that number of deaths as well, maybe around 240 or so. But we have 2 million people here. And one of the big things to note is that Hidalgo is a heavily Latino community, and we have seen this virus disproportionately affect people of color. It affects the Black community, affects the Latino community, and so you're seeing a higher number of deaths in a county that is very heavily populated by Latinos.
We're also hearing about a large number of infections of infants.
Yes, so on Friday, Nueces County announced that it was adding 85 infants that have tested positive for COVID-19. And the public health director, she had said that these babies have not celebrated even their first birthday yet. And that's about all the information that we have so far as to these children. So we are starting to see this virus affect very, very young children, even at a point where Texas is debating on reopening schools.
Are people taking this seriously when you're out and you're reporting? Do you see mask usage?
After the cases just started increasing exponentially, the governor put in a statewide mask order for counties that have more than 20 cases of COVID. And you have some folks that aren't comfortable wearing masks. You have some folks that refuse to wear masks. But I've noticed that since it's come back, at least here in San Antonio, that mask wearing has gone way, way, way up just from my own being out and about in some cases.
Joey Palacio from Texas Public Radio, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Hari.
For more national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. Tributes to civil rights leader and member of Congress John Lewis continued today. Lewis died Friday of pancreatic cancer. Many of his colleagues called for the renaming and passage of a bill that would restore a part of the Voting Rights Act already passed in the House. House Majority Whip James Clyburn called on President Trump and Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell to take up the bill.
If the president were to sign that, then I think that's what we would do to honor John. It should be the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act of 2020. That's the way to do it. Words may be powerful, but deeds are lasting.
Demonstrators, police, and federal agents clashed again last night on the streets of Portland, Oregon. Outside the federal courthouse, protesters removed protective fencing and set fires. Federal agents protecting the building used tear gas to clear the area. Protests against police brutality and racism in this section of downtown Portland have been ongoing since the police killing of George Floyd in late May. But the recent deployment of federal agents under President Trump's executive order to protect monuments and buildings has reignited sometimes violent clashes. In a tweet today, President Trump said, quote, "We are trying to help Portland, not hurt it. Their leadership has, for months, lost control of the anarchists and agitators." Both the governor of Oregon and Portland's mayor have said the federal presence is making the situation worse. Over the past week, militarized federal agents detained protesters using unmarked cars. Late Friday, the state's attorney general sued Homeland Security and the Marshal Service in federal court, arguing such detention is unconstitutional. A European Union summit stretched into an unplanned third day today as the 27-nation bloc tried to reach an agreement on a $2.1 trillion EU budget and coronavirus relief package. Disagreement over a proposed seven-year, $857 million coronavirus fund became the main sticking point on Saturday. Some of the wealthier northern European countries, the so-called frugal nations led by the Netherlands, want strict controls on spending, while southern European countries like hard-hit Spain and Italy argue conditions on the coronavirus aid should be minimal. In China, at least 14 people have died and tens of thousands have been evacuated during days of heavy rains and severe seasonal flooding. In southern and eastern regions of the country, the Yangtze River and some of its tributaries are far above flood levels. One levee broke and officials opened floodgates in other areas to prevent more damage. Rescue workers were sent into towns where homes and shops remain underwater. China's central and southern regions experience seasonal flooding annually, but rainfall so far this year has been unusually high. It's not surprising that healthcare workers on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic face increased chances of contracting COVID-19. They risk lost wages, expensive healthcare costs, and potential death. What is surprising is that sick workers and families of those who've died from the virus are finding themselves fighting for workers' compensation. A recent Kaiser Health News report found that in some states, the chances of getting benefits paid are a long shot. I recently spoke with Christina Jewett, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. So, what is happening to many healthcare workers as they go back to their hospitals and say, hey, I got COVID, I've got all these bills, I've been out of work for weeks? What happens to them?
Employers and the insurance carriers are asking workers to pinpoint how they got COVID at work. So in the case of a doctor or an RN, you might have a really bulky medical record to look through and say, oh, you know, this patient this day, this is what I believe happened. But what we found was there was a, you know, a laundry worker, a maintenance worker, someone changing the air filters in a COVID room. Those workers were getting their claims denied. I mean, it's very hard for a worker in that position to pinpoint a single patient. They're probably not even privy to that knowledge. So those were the cases that we saw popping up where workers were initially seeing denials.
So if they're cleaning the sheets of sick patients and if they're cleaning the air filters from the room full of COVID-19 air, they still have to prove that that's how they got COVID in the first place to get compensation.
Yeah, in most states, the burden's on the worker. The worker has to pinpoint how they got it. But there are a spate of laws that are coming online. Legislatures all over the country are looking at these types of laws. There's 16 laws addressing this. And what they've done is turned the tables and made that presumption that, look, if you're a healthcare worker, some states it's an essential employee, you got it at work, and now the employer would have to prove that you didn't. So then the employer is starting to ask questions about, you know, what your cousin, you know, where your cousin's been or sort of what happened on the bus you were riding to work. So it's a lot easier for workers in those states, but it's just really a mixed bag around the country.
So is there resistance to that idea? These states that are passing this legislation, is there a reason that the other states haven't joined yet?
The resistance is over cost. This is just an insurance line, just, you know, like any other insurance cost to a business. And, you know, the thought is that if they have to pay out these claims, some of them potentially lifetime benefits to a surviving spouse or lifetime benefits if a worker has residual long-term problems, that those costs could potentially cripple businesses and prevent them from reopening the way we want to see things happen. So that's sort of the flip side argument to, you know, really covering the workers.
You have been chronicling the lives of so many of these healthcare workers who've died during this pandemic. What surprised you when you were reporting on these stories about the families who are trying to get compensation?
We worked on this story in another in close proximity, and the sister of a nurse who recently died, she talked about the last days that her sister lived. And one of the things she spent time doing was proving that she got COVID at work for her own workers' compensation claim that she was expecting to backfill some lost wages. That was something she spent the last days of her life doing, where her employer certainly had those records where they could have seen she cared for a patient who, you know, at the time she cared for him, wasn't known that person had COVID, but later it became apparent that was a COVID patient. So that was a little bit saddening, just to know that that's a person who bravely, you know, went to work caring for incredibly sick patients and had that as sort of some of the last hours of their waking life.
Christina Jewett of Kaiser Health News, thanks so much.
Thank you, Hari.
Advances in healthcare and changes in public policy have helped increase the life expectancy for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Many of them now live at home. But for the hundreds of thousands of aging caregivers of adult children with disabilities, many worry about what happens when they can no longer care for their loved ones. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker traveled to Rock County, Wisconsin to see what one community is doing to prepare. This story is part of our ongoing series, Rethinking Lifespan, and parts were reported before the COVID-19 pandemic restrictions were in effect.
It was just a few months after Virginia Sockwell gave birth to her second son, Kent, that his health took a turn. Within a few days, he was back in the hospital, undergoing surgery to remove part of his bowel. But he lost consciousness several times during the surgery, which led to brain damage.
We always thought he was going to recover because he was actually looking pretty good. But it was a long time before we said, well, he's just not going to get a lot better anymore.
The damage was permanent. Kent can't walk unassisted and has very limited verbal skills.
Oh, Kent, what are you up to now?
And for the past 51 years, it's been his parents, Ron and Virginia, caring for him in rural Wisconsin.
Did you think you would still be in this caregiving position at your age?
Absolutely not. I didn't think I'd be.
Well, I didn't know who else was going to do it. I always said, you know, 70s, that's about it. You get to be 80, it's over. Well, then you get to be 80 and you say, well, maybe 90, it'll be over.
Both 85, the Sockwells are not alone among people their age caring for someone with an intellectual or developmental disability. In fact, there are estimates that between 800,000 and 1 million Americans over 60 are providing such care for a loved one. And many are not prepared for the day they can no longer do it.
And so it's important to get ahead of that crisis and help families to think about what happens next when I can't provide that care.
Lisa Pugh is the head of the Wisconsin chapter of a nonprofit called The ARC, a disability advocacy organization. As the mother of a daughter with intellectual and developmental disabilities, she could immediately relate to the Sockwells.
Meeting people like Virginia and Ron really is a gift to me in that it's kind of a window into my own future, into our family's future, and it helps me to kind of tackle my own fears and think about the sorts of things that my husband and I want for our daughter and how we can take those incremental steps.
Pugh notes that as people live longer, including those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, there is increased pressure on family caregivers who are often not paid. There are state and federal programs available, the majority of which are funded through Medicaid, but the need for support often outweighs the availability of services. As a result, across the country, close to 600,000 people are on waiting lists for community and home-based services like skilled nursing care or physical therapy, according to the health nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation. But Lisa Pugh says Wisconsin has been working to change that.
Wisconsin has done a pretty revolutionary thing in that we don't have the same long waiting lists as there are in other states for the programs. We've done a good job investing in the sorts of infrastructure that families need in order to access supports.
In the late 1990s, the state opened aging and disability resource centers to give people access to information within their community. It has since expanded long-term care services. Wisconsin also changed the way it allocates money. In 2008, some families began to manage their state funds directly, giving them greater say in what type of services they receive. According to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, this has helped reduce wait times, which they say will be eliminated by next year. But even with these changes, challenges remain.
So while you might be able to walk in the door and you take a screen and they say, yes, you are functionally and financially eligible for long-term services and support, your challenge is going to be finding the workers to fill those shifts.
For the Sockwells, Medicaid pays for Kent's day services and an aide who, prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, would take Kent swimming and do other activities with him. Now, during the current health crisis, those activities are done behind a mask or shield at the Sockwell home. But it's Kent's parents who do the bulk of the work. They bathe him, dress him, and feed him daily. But a question looms over the daily routine. Who will do this after they're gone?
Where would you place where you folks are now in terms of preparation?
I would say the very beginning.
Yeah.
We've been looking. We've been thinking. We've been thinking a lot about it, but I guess we don't know where to go.
If the Sockwells die without a plan in place, the decision for Kent's ongoing care will either end up with his older brother, or it may end up with the state. That means a social worker would step in, and he would then be placed in emergency housing as he waited for a long-term solution that may never come.
So he would be moved from his home, from the home he's lived in for however many years.
Stephanie Prim is the executive director of a Wisconsin disability service provider, Love, Inc.
He would be grieving his parents, and then he would be put into a setting that was brand new to him, with potentially roommates with other disabilities that were brand new to him, caregivers he had never met before. It's a very, very traumatic experience for these individuals.
Are there things that the state or the federal government could do to help within this process?
A lot of the funding in the service system is directed at the individual with the disability, which is where it should be directed. But a lot, it neglects the needs of the caregiver and the support for the caregiver to do things that are creative, that are outside the box.
Late last year, the ARC Wisconsin and Love, Inc. started getting families in Rock County together to talk and plan. That means setting up a financial trust or securing long-term housing for a disabled son or daughter. Virginia Sockwell was in attendance at one of the meetings. So were a couple of 92-year-olds, Betty and Frank Daniels. They and one of their eldest daughters were there to talk about another child, 56-year-old Patty.
Patty was a beautiful baby. When we brought her home from the hospital, it seemed like, well, everything will be okay when we get her home.
But it wasn't. The infant had trouble feeding, the result of respiratory problems, and then she developed seizures. By the time Patty turned 2, she was diagnosed with an intellectual disability. But with a family of 11 brothers and sisters, the Daniels say Patty has led a full life. And by several measures, the Daniels are much further along with their preparation for Patty's continuing care after they pass away. They have a financial trust for her and guardians in place who are aware of her needs. And she has long-term housing. Since her early 20s, Patty has been living in a group home, paid for by Medicaid and Social Security disability benefits.
Our philosophy was that we never wanted the rest of our children to have to take care of Patty. We didn't feel it was fair to them or right for Patty. She needed a place of her own, and that's where we were really thought the group home was a perfect solution.
But despite the early preparation, they haven't stopped worrying.
We've tried to look ahead and get as many of those things taken care of as we can. But there's always a struggle.
Love, Inc. and the ARC are there to help with that struggle. They've created what they call toolkits to help parents and caregivers prepare. These kits serve as a central place to record important life details like bank information, doctors, or designated guardians. They can even provide prompts about how to talk about planning for the future. Meanwhile, Wisconsin's Governor Tony Evers has created the state's first ever task force on caregiving, hoping to recruit more workers like nursing assistants and expand support for unpaid family members. Lisa Pugh of the ARC Wisconsin is on that task force, and the solutions it comes up with could have an impact on her family and her daughter's future.
Any family wants their loved one to be accepted and part of the community, and that she'll have her own life.
You're certainly putting in a hell of an effort to make sure that happens.
Yeah. I'm glad I've got a lot of years ahead of me to plan for it, too.
This is the kind of...
And for the Sockwells,
what do you worry most about when you're thinking about caring for Kent?
Us dying. I pray every morning I'm alive again to change his diapers. Really, I do. I'm just happy that I can still do that.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.